This is The Agenda from News Radio 560, KPQ, and KPQ.com, where topics of local concern are open for discussion.
Well, busy power-packed hour. This hour, we welcome Wenatchee Mayor Frank Kuntz, and later on in our second half, we're going to have Chelan County Sheriff Brian Burnett. We're going to talk about extreme risk protection orders. Because all you hear on some of the national discussion is, we need to have some sort of a red flag laws instituted or implemented at the national level. And our state is one of those that they mention as already have something along that line in place. So we'll talk about that in the second half hour. Welcome, Mr. Mayor. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thank you.
Oh, you're on number four here. Let me push number four on instead of number three. Thanks for being a part of the program today.
You bet, Dave. Always great to be here.
Topically, as I mentioned, the tragedies of the mass shootings. When you look up and you see mayors from across the country conducting these terrible press conferences, God forbid we'd ever be in a situation here in our valley. But I'm sure your heart goes out to your fellow mayors.
Yeah, it's real. I mean, not only to the mayors that have to deal with this, but obviously those that who've lost their lives and families and friends of those victims. And, you know, you keep your fingers crossed that it's not going to be Wenatchee at one point in time, that something tragically isn't going to happen here. We've had a couple of arrests with some folks with guns in the back of their car that probably in a mental condition that shouldn't have guns in the back of their car. We've had a couple of officer-involved shootings in my mayor time, and those have fortunately all come out as justified. And so I tell people all the time, you have no idea what today's going to be, even though my calendar may have five meetings and meeting with KPQ at 12:15, because if something happens, I'll get pulled a certain direction or not. And we had a few of those. We had some terrible fires. We had a bunch of stuff early on in my mayorship where I was on CNN and some of these things, you know, telling people what's going on in Wenatchee, where the fires are doing and those sorts of things. So, you know, when the governor's visiting your town, you hopefully it's for something good, not something bad. And, you know, I do watch this stuff, see how the other mayors are handling. I'm on an email chain with most of the rest of the mayors in the country. I tend to stay out of the sort of national issues. I think there's 200 plus mayors who have signed a letter to Congress to say, you know, we need gun control. I tend not to sign those letters. I just tend to watch them and see what goes on. But I do feel for our friends in Dayton and El Paso and other places. You know, there was a shooting in California earlier last night or this morning that, you know, an officer lost his life, and it's just like, you just don't like to see that happen.
Yeah, Chip. Flood control, real quick. You know, you never know when the storm cell and where it's going to throw the water and the mud. And, of course, a terrible flood there in the Boudry Street there. But we've had flooding in, of all places, near Waterville. Mudslides into a home in Waterville. Who would ever think that? So, you know, with the assessments you get from City of Wenatchee Public Works and all of that, how is our city shaping up in terms of stormwater drainage and control?
I want to say we've handled this stuff fairly well inside the city limits of the city. You know, we've had three or four sort of major events even this year. We had one in July that popped most of the manhole covers, and there was some basement flooding in some spots, and even my little office building had a bunch of the vegetation ripped away and stuff. So we have them. We do our best to try to maintain it. Where it gets difficult is when these rain events take place either in unincorporated Chelan County or on, you know, Forest Service lands, BLM, other sorts of state ownership. They come through county land, and then you start trying to handle mud in our stormwater system. And stormwater systems are designed to handle water, not mud. And when they start getting clogged up, then you start seeing the sorts of problems that we've had in the past. So this time, you know, the one on Saturday on Fifth Street sort of handled the north side of Fifth Street. So Lester Road got some washouts and Westwick and some of those sort of streets. You know, a lot of times in the ones in the past, it was the other side of Fifth Street that got, you know, Canyon Place and Lars Lane and some of those streets. And then a little bit more, you know, we've had number two Canyon earlier this year, got a kind of the brunt of it. Well, now this time it was, you know, Skolchuk drainage. And so it just sort of depends where the shower decides to hang out. We can do better. We continue to work with the county and the flood control district on, you know, the sorts of things that can help. Top of Fifth Street, there's, I think, three sort of detention ponds that are designed to sort of slow down the flow of water. I haven't got a report back to see how they worked on Saturday. I wasn't here to go up and look at them. But that's regularly the first place I will go. If I see a big rain event around here, I drive up Fifth Street, and I go look at those detention ponds to see if they're holding water and are they working the way they're supposed to. So we just keep trying to do the best we can. I feel sorry for those folks on Boozer and Boudry Street down there that got a rock slide, and hopefully they found a place to live, and it sounds like it might be a while before they get to put a mobile home back on those properties.
Yeah, fortunately, no life lost. Possessions can be replaced, but sometimes some folks are in some difficult positions in terms of their ability to ensure that. That is unfortunate sometimes.
And nice to see both police departments working. I saw the picture in the paper where our officer Magnuson was carrying some folks out, and Sheriff's Deputy Randy Lake was carrying some folks out. So sort of like first come, first serve. Who's there? Let's get the job done. So
we're talking with Wenatchee Mayor Frank Koontz. The Wenatchee City Council has accepted the homeless grant funding recommendations for the next two-year period. There's been some back and forth with the some of the county opinions on how money should be allocated. Again, let's kind of revisit your view. You wanted to make sure that things like hotel vouchers remained in place and some of the programs for service providers didn't get impacted. So how did the council decision play into that?
Well, I'll say, I think from a 30,000-foot level, I'd say the first thing that I tried to tell the two county commissioners that didn't like the way the city handled that stuff, there's slightly more than $3.2 million that was allocated over the last month and a half. I think we agreed on 97% of the allocations, right? So it wasn't like, you know, we're just fighting over just a few hundred thousand dollars here or there. You know, a few hundred thousand dollars, if you're going to try to put it into building low-income housing, isn't going to go very far. But $300,000 or $400,000 to Women's Resource Center, or the YWCA's Women's Homeless Shelter, or some of the other providers, is a whole bunch of money and keeps them open and operating and doing the things they need to do. So the city's thought was that we should get as much into programs as possible, recognizing that there is a couple of legislature has passed a couple of new bills that's going to give us some state rebate money, some money from the state to help. And that money probably should go into building and, trying to more capital in nature if possible. So I'd like to think we agree on most things and disagreed on a few things. So I would like to think the county commissioners would look at the glass as being almost completely full, not completely empty over one or two small items.
We're getting some update on a kind of a potpourri of items here on our visit with Wenatchee Mayor Frank Koontz. Where is the Black Rock Terrace project at? Neighbors, Department of Fish and Wildlife were concerned about impacts to deer habitat. The proposal up on the Skyline Drive there with the trams trying to put in a new housing development up there. Where is that project at right now?
So I think it's interesting, at least for some of your listeners, to understand that when cities do stuff, we set zoning rules, right? And we sort of set land development rules, right? So we're not going to put a Walmart in a residential area. If you're going to build a Walmart, you better put sidewalks in. If you're going to put in a housing development, you need sidewalks, streetlights, water, sewer, those sorts of things. The person who interprets our laws for us is someone called a hearing examiner. And so when the tramps, for instance, for Black Rock went in and said, we want to do this and that and this and that, the hearing examiner is the one who looks at our zoning laws and says, well, does it fit with zoning? And then looks at our development code and says, does it fit the city's development code? The hearing examiner said, yes, it did. And the neighbor said, no, it didn't. And Fish and Wildlife said, no, it didn't. So that has actually gone to court. And there was a hearing in front of Judge Brandt probably 4 or 5 weeks ago. He has not, as far as I know, issued his ruling yet. He's got, I believe, 90 days to do so. So at some point, the judge will say, yes, the hearing examiner was right, or no, the hearing examiner was wrong. And then we'll stop and see what he says. If he remands it back to the hearing examiner, that'll happen. If he makes his ruling and we're done, then there's other appeal processes. So it is currently in a very legal process. We are watching it very closely. We have other Foothills development sort of in the works. We're hearing from other developers that want to do stuff similar. And so the issue is, well, are we going to have to change one of our codes? Are we, I mean, how's this all going to sort of play out? So we're watching. We're waiting for a judge's ruling. But the judge's ruling, as we know, isn't the end, because the city could appeal. The property owners could appeal. Fish and Wildlife could appeal. I don't know who's going to appeal. So right now this is an illegal situation, and we're just sort of watching it.
Yeah, so their precedent is going to perhaps be set with this decision.
It is. There's some inconsistencies between, say, the city code that limits your fence height to 6 feet and Fish and Wildlife's code that says the fences have to be 8 feet if you're going to protect deer. Well, who wins? Does the state's Fish and Wildlife law trump the city's law? Well, I think the city says no. The city has the right to control its zoning and fence heights inside the city limits of the city of Wenatchee. And I think we would look long and hard at someone saying, no, we don't have that ability. So you know, that's just one of the examples where you go, I don't know what the judge is going to say.
Well, right now folks driving around town are seeing those little yellow tabs all over the place pavement lines have been ground off, and those are your temporary guides. And I know in certain areas they've begun there's a lot of different techniques and process to repave the roads. What is this actual technique we're using this time around?
We're using what's called a hot chip. So we're not fully repaving the streets where you cut out an inch and a half or two and repave. That is, one, extremely expensive, and then requires all of the sidewalks in those areas to become ADA compatible, which even makes it more expensive. We're not doing that, and we're not doing what's called a cold chip, which I was in East Wenatchee yesterday, and they've just done some cold chip, where you put down oil and rock, and you drive over it for a while, and then you sort of sweep it up. So this is oil, and then the rock is actually treated and is already mixed in oil. So if you're driving out North Wenatchee Avenue, and you get to the old WashDOT site, and you look to the right, and you see a big old pile of black rock, that is what's going down on our city streets. It was supposed to start yesterday, but the contractor is a week behind in another city, so my understanding, they're going to start next Monday. We had tried to get this scheduled so all the city streets would be paved before school starts. Looks to me like they're not quite going to make that window because of this delay. So next Monday, and they're going to do, I think, 15 miles of roadway, 45 lane miles in 2 weeks. So it's not going to take them a long time once they get started. But they're going to put down this hot chip. We'll see how it works in the city. It's the folks in Leavenworth have done it and loved it. WashDOT did a bunch of that between on the highway to Chelan a couple years ago. They liked the results.
Been pretty durable.
Quite a bit cheaper. We'll see how it handles city traffic, though. You know, city traffic on Miller's going to get it. You know, that's different than highway traffic. That's different than Western Avenue traffic. So we're trying to experiment with cost-effective ways to make these road improvements happen, maintain the life of our roads. So this contract was $2.9 million, so that's a lot of money for a city of Wenatchee to do. You know, that's money from $20 car tabs and property taxes from our friends out in Old Station, that sort of new revenue to the city. So we're excited to get out and get those roads sort of repaved and make their useful life a little bit longer. We got a big project again next year. And then we're sort of like, what do we do next? Because we're sort of spending our savings account. We're trying to get money out in the road systems in a way that's reasonable. But we still don't have a long-term revenue source and plan to maintain all of our city streets. And that's frustrating to me. We just haven't quite got there yet.
Speaking of roads, the North Wenatchee Avenue Corridor Improvement Project, you've been trying to get the grant funding for that. It's either yes or no, thumbs up, thumbs down?
Pretty much. Sometimes they'll give you a thumbs up and not give you all that you asked for. So we were asking for just something south of $150 million. They could have come to us and said, hey, what can you get done for 80 or 90? And we could have said, well, we can do these two or three phases of it. We never got that phone call, and the list came out, which means we didn't make the list. So we've done it twice. There is a third round of infra, which will probably happen again next year, January, February. We will apply for a third time. We think we're working our way up the list. We've had good conversations with USDOT, And at the end of the day, I don't know how political this all becomes. We do have a Republican president. You have a Republican Secretary of Transportation, Chao. We are in a clearly a Democratic state with two Democratic U.S. senators, a Democratic governor, and our current congresswoman is Democratic in our district. I don't know how much that has to play. We are going under the assumption it doesn't have anything to play. They're going to fund the best projects, and we're going to get ours up there to the point where it's one of the best.
So it's safety, congestion, transit travel time, walking, biking amenities, overall aesthetics. But that's only for kind of phase one of the overall plan out there, right?
There's a lot. We've got some money already from the state to help work with the intersection. We call it the Starbucks intersection, which is sort of Starbucks, Walmart, that little intersection. The long-term play is North Wenatchee Avenue will function, hopefully function, something similar to State Route 99 in and around SeaTac Airport, where it's sort of all right in, right out, and there's medians in the middle of the street, and U-turn available at the signals. That's just the way we sort of envision North Wenatchee Avenue functioning, you know, in 10 years or so, with Confluence Parkway being another avenue to get out that direction, some improvements in Douglas County out by the Odabashan Bridge in Cascade. So we've got a lot sort of going on trying to keep our transportation loop effective and working. As I've told our Congress folks, you know, we're not on the highway system. We don't have a U.S. highway running anywhere very close to us. These are all state highways. We don't get a lot of federal money in our area. So this would be a good chance for to get some federal participation in our local transportation community. So we're hopeful. We'll keep trying.
All right. Wenatchee Mayor Frank Koontz, thank you for the update.
You bet. Thanks, Dave.
Appreciate it. All right. Up next, we're going to talk about extreme risk protection orders, ERPOs. Chelan County Sheriff Brian Burnett, our guest next on The Agenda.
You're listening to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KPQ, KPQ.com, and streaming on Alexa or the KPQ mobile app.
All righty. Thanks for joining us on The Agenda. And in our second half hour, real delighted to have Chelan County Sheriff Brian Burnett and Chief of Operations. Did I get the title right, Jason?
Yes.
Jason Reinfeld from the Chelan County Sheriff's Office as well. So I don't care whether you watch CNN, you watch Fox, or any of the channels, you're seeing a lot of discussion about perhaps having some sort of national, they're calling or using the term red flag laws. And when they throw the map up on the screen, you'll see Washington State as one of the states that they indicate, you know, already has some form of this. In our state, they call them kind of an extreme risk protection order. So we thought we'd bring in some law enforcement for a little bit of perspective on this. So I called Chelan County Sheriff Brian Burnett. If you could give us a little bit of an explanation, and he's brought Chief of Operations Jason Reinfeld along as well. But when I called you, Sheriff, I was a little bit surprised to learn how few of these have been put in place, for instance, in Chelan County. And if you could share that, I was a little bit surprised.
I guess. And I don't know what the numbers are statewide, but actually, Dave, we just served our first one just this last week as the first one. And, you know, let me back up just a little bit. You know, this comes down from a lot of people get pretty upset is when we've seen some different shooting, aggressive, violent acts, people with firearms, and they've got some mental health history and some different things like that. After the fact and the event, there's always that critique of why didn't law enforcement or XYZ, you fill in the letters there, do something about this ahead of time. It's because the legality of that. One, you have to have information that there's a problem, and you have to have a legal system that provides you the avenue to do that in a legal manner. And then you have the other side says, when someone does go in and try to secure weapons because there's concerns of mental health issues on that person, then you have other people concerned about Second Amendment rights and such like that. So obviously there's a fine balance here in trying to work within the system and doing what is right by the people, but also to protect individuals from persons that we believe could act erratically under those conditions with firearms.
So, Jason, I guess your initial thoughts on whether it's the discussion that we're hearing across the country right now or that we've only had kind of one of these so far in Chelan County. Maybe that's a good thing that we've only had one of these.
Well, it is. It's a it's like the sheriff said, it's kind of a touchy subject. You don't want to err either direction on this, so it's something you want to get right. And the intent of this law is to prevent violence before it takes place.
So with these ERPOs, as they you guys kind of use the acronym ERPOs, is that kind of the phrase that kind of the lingo in law enforcement and the legal profession?
It's not something we come across a lot, so that's the abbreviation Extreme Risk Protection Order in our state.
In the kind of the national discussion, national debate right now, it's like see something, say something. In the case of the Parkland shooting, we had a young man that was exhibiting all kinds of examples of and had lots of interactions with law enforcement, and maybe in that case, if we'd had that kind of law in place, but there were other sorts of laws that if they had just been, implemented, might have prevented that sort of shooting. What do you guys think about this particular law? I guess it's your job to enforce the laws, but one of the things that I get kind of wondering about with this ERPO law is on the national debate, they're talking about if you see something, say something, perhaps an abuse of this law. What are the due process protections for someone who is a gun owner that could be wrongfully accused of and have their weapons taken away from them? How does that part work?
I think I'll let Chief of Special Operations Jason Reinfeld talk about that, just because we just went through this process and he walked through it.
How does that work if I say I think my neighbor's crazy and I'm afraid he's going to harm someone or go shoot up something? How does that part work, Jason?
If you're looking at your neighbor, it's something that you're going to need to get law enforcement involved in. The mechanism we have with these extreme risk protection orders requires a family or a household member of the respondent, the person who's going to be served this order, or law enforcement to make the petition. And what happens is they complete a petition, which is pretty lengthy, where you provide reasons, evidence, criminal history, anything relevant to this fear that you have. You fill out the petition, and then that's brought to the court. And a judge looks at that and determines whether or not they should be served with this protection order. And then the next step is a court date is set up within 14 days of the service, and they have their opportunity to go to court and represent themselves or have an attorney.
So it can only be a family member that can do the petition?
It's family or household or law enforcement.
Okay. What if there's I guess I'm going to throw out some scenarios, but don't expect you guys to cast judgment on this, but if a family member is sympathetic or reluctant to do that, this sort of thing doesn't get triggered then, correct?
No, you'd have to have another individual that would bring it to the attention of law enforcement. Law enforcement would have to have, enough information to base the petition on.
Okay, so that's where, like, if a neighbor was concerned, that's maybe where the law enforcement can take a look at a situation then.
Correct.
I was looking on some online and some forums, and I found this one forum that there's an extreme risk protection order form to have the records sealed, that the respondent or that the person can basically have the fact that they've had their an ERPO against them. That can be sealed from public review. I don't expect you to be an expert at all the forums, because there was probably three dozen forums on there, but is that a part of this process as well, apparently?
That's not a part of our initial process.
That's all part of the court process.
Yeah, and I think that's on them for when it's concluded, if it's been served, if it's been lifted. That probably gives them the opportunity at that point.
How does it work when you get one of these orders? Does it come to you first? Does it come from the court system first? How does the sheriff's office get contacted that there's a petition against Joe Blow and his family is concerned? How does that part work, Jason?
So it's brought down to our records department, and they're required to enter that into the criminal justice information system just so it's in a database and law enforcement knows about it elsewhere. From that point, it goes, in our case, to our civil department. They prepare all our paper services, and a deputy will go out and serve this paperwork.
Sheriff, do you think this is a good tool? Is this a tool that's been helpful? I mean, we see some of the national discussion that the politicians are saying this is a great tool. Just from a law enforcement perspective, do you think this is a good tool or not?
I think it's a piece. I mean, it's a tool in the toolbox. It's never going to be an end-all answer to all the concerns. Because one is when we go to serve these, part of it is based on how much the person that the petition is against for them to surrender their firearms, are they a willing participant? Are they giving us? We don't necessarily know what they have in their possession. So we could go in and they could give us 10 firearms, but they could have 11 or 12 that we don't know about. I mean, so again, this is, you know, for somebody that doesn't want to submit and participate in the system and go along willingly, or you find somebody that's really egregious in their behavior and their actions and their intent, and we're going to have a hard time dealing with that. But again, these are trying to stop the behavior, I think, ahead of time and try to curb that and eliminate potential pieces to the puzzle as people try to put these things together before they go and do these acts of violence.
And I noticed that when I was clicking on this website and printing out at least one of these forms, there is a little bit of a list. It's got a few boxes or a little bit of a form where someone would be listing voluntarily their weapons that they would be surrendering, and it said something about that it's in effect for a year and then has to be reviewed after a year, but if they aren't truthful, that they're gonna have even more of a penalty. Question to ask for you: how long have these ERPOs been in place? How long has this extreme risk protection order process been in place in Washington State, Jason?
I think it was 2017.
Okay, so a couple of years. Yeah. Do we have anything like this before that, or something remotely like this before that?
I don't think there's anything that compares to this. I think firearms losses were as a result of a crime, court order, that type of thing.
Or due to a domestic violence arrest and ordered by the judge pending their probable cause hearing and stuff like that. I mean, and even the ERPO itself, you know, this has gone before the mass shooting group that convened last year when we got into talking about school safety and different things. Persons in the group wanted to bring up that they wanted to make a recommendation that ERPOs would be applicable to juveniles, and we're like, well, it doesn't make any sense because the juveniles don't have the right to possess those firearms in the first place, so why would you go in and put an order against someone that doesn't have the right anyway? And so it's just, I mean, there's been so much discussion, Dave, on this topic and firearms, mental health. You posed the question just a few minutes ago, was, you know, how good of a tool is this? And it's just a piece, and it's just something like that. It's unfortunate in our society that we even have to go down this road to look at these type of orders. But again, this is, you know, puts a lot of responsibility on the family, persons that reside with this person in a residence, and or neighbors to contact your local law enforcement to talk about concerns and behaviors, or, you know, potential criminal behavior, obviously. And I think it's just one of those things is we have to continue to keep that conversation going. But also on the other side is what are those, you know, there's concerns that people will be, family member will take advantage of others that really haven't done that because they're trying to do, you know, remove their firearms for whatever reason, retaliation or whatever. And that's a concern on people as well. And again, that's why it's there's a lot of information that has to be provided in these orders and gone before one of our judges and reviewed, and then they're the ones that make those decisions. It's not just you can sign your name on the dotted line and law enforcement is just going to take that for a word of fact and go and do it. It's just not that simple.
So, again, we're talking with Chelan County Sheriff Brian Burnett, Chief of Operations Jason Reinfeld, and if you just joined us in the interview, we started off with the point that you've only had one of these orders that you actually had to enforce. Have you had more than one in terms of petitions, or have you been approached with more than one, I guess, request or inquiry by residents that, and I don't know how much of this you can share legally, but can you give us a perspective on that?
So this, I don't recall any other instances where this has been brought up outside the domestic violence realm where that's takes place anyway. This is kind of unique to us, and it's fairly new. Like we said, this is pretty recent, the one we have done.
Okay. Do you anticipate that, I guess, I don't know even that is even a fair question, do you anticipate that with kind of a little bit of the mood raised or the awareness raised with this discussion kind of going on nationally in light of these more recent shootings that you might get more inquiries? Any thoughts on that?
I definitely would think potentially. But obviously, I mean, you know, you have to look at the behavior and the mannerisms from the persons that you're concerned about. Not all of these, you know, mass shooting type of things happen from the same demeanor or mindset of the persons. Did they have mental health issues and concerns? Some of them, yes. Did someone have a instance where they became seriously emotional and distraught through a series of events over a shorter period of time that led them to get into that egregious behavior? So, I mean, may or may not be there for people to actually know and have knowledge of. But when you get that long history of people acting out, talking, and family members are seeing some behavior from that person over a course of time, that, you know, I think it becomes a point where at what point in time am I obligated when I know this to go forward? And I think that you're better off to go forward and have a conversation with somebody and talk that over to decide, is this something that warrants moving forward potentially with a process like that? Doesn't mean you have to file for it right away, but reach out to your resources and have those conversations if you've got some concerning behavior and going on from someone that you know, live with, or a loved one or a family member.
Well, I know just from sitting in the newsroom, working in the newsroom, and we hear over the scanner, there are a lot of calls every single day where officers are responding to a concern over someone with a weapon or someone, there is a weapon in the household. You just hear that interplay. The dispatcher is telling the officer, no matter what the agency, of a concern about someone. So want all you guys and gals to be safe out there, but I know it's just a constant interaction when you're out responding for a variety of calls for whatever the reason. So stay safe out there, and thanks for taking some time to share some information. Jason, did you have a final thought? I know Sheriff kind of gave a great piece of advice there. When you're concerned about something, particularly within a family member who you know best, don't be afraid to have that conversation. Your thoughts, your final thoughts.
I think he summed it up well. That's exactly why this is in place, and that's why family members and law enforcement can petition for this. They know the person best, and they can make that judgment.
Okay. Appreciate the time today. Jason Reinfeld, the Chief of Operations, and Chelan County Sheriff Brian Burnett joining us today. Give us a little insight on these ERPOs, Extreme Risk Protection Orders. We're kind of being pointed to as one of the states that has a little bit of this red flag type of law that they're perhaps talking about at the national level. A whole different ball of wax, I think, from a constitutional issue at the national level, but it's maybe a little easier to put these in place statewide, and we're one of the states they're talking about. Gentlemen, thanks for being here, and stay safe.
Thanks, Dave.
All righty.